So I was sleeping when the quake hit. I've slept through small earthquakes before, but boy, not this one. The whole house was shaking. You know it's bad when you actually kind of lose your balance as you're trying to walk in a straight line. I ran from my door and I almost stumbled and fell over as it was the whole house was shaking. I'm on the 11th floor though, so maybe I felt it a little more than some other people in Taipei.
Hello and welcome to Getting Pacific, where we get specific on trending topics straight from the newsroom here at Taiwan Plus. I am Joey Chow.
And I am Trevor Tortomasi.
And this week, we're talking about the earthquake that hit Taiwan this month.
A magnitude 7.2 earthquake hit Taiwan this morning with the epicenter off the coast of Hualien County in the country's east. And the quake has caused major damage to buildings and roads throughout the country. It's the largest tremor to hit Taiwan in 25 years. Search and rescue efforts are underway. But we begin our coverage of the quake with Tiffany Wong in Taipei.
Starting the day with a magnitude 7.2 earthquake, it struck just before 8 a.m. off Taiwan's coastal city of Hualien and could be felt around the country, toppling buildings, triggering a tsunami warning, and causing landslides. In the capital of Taipei, over 100 kilometers from Hualien, residents were left rattled. The strong tremor and several aftershocks brought traffic around the island to a standstill during the morning rush hour, while officials inspected the metro, train, and high-speed rail systems.
Yeah, so we're looking into the earthquake that happened just last week for us, but we're going to focus a little bit more on the recovery and Taiwan's earthquake responses, and mainly paint a picture for you if you've never really experienced an earthquake before, what it's like to live on the Pacific Ring of Fire, and how we can prepare for something that we're almost never quite sure when to expect. But first, here are some basic facts. So on Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024, at 7:58 a.m., the earthquake, magnitude 7.2, struck just off Taiwan's east coast near the city of Hualien. Current reports note a death toll of 13, with more than 1,000 people injured, and rescue efforts have been vigilant over the past couple weeks to rescue those who are trapped or stranded due to rockfalls. It was Taiwan's biggest earthquake in 25 years.
That's right, and the problem with an earthquake that's epicentered on the eastern coast of Taiwan is that there's usually only one or two main routes that can get to those areas, so rescue efforts are still continuing. More than 800 aftershocks have been tallied in the week since the initial quake, with more than 30 of which are between magnitudes 5 to 7, which is pretty big. The Central Weather Administration has announced that continued fault activities could lead to more major earthquakes and advising people against going into mountainous areas.
Yeah, so some of the people that are trapped, maybe not trapped under rocks, but trapped on roads in the mountains. And so even if we know where some people are, getting them out of there has been a challenge. And there are a lot of mountainous roads going in and out of Hualien, so we have to be careful around those.
Yeah. Trevor, what were you doing or where were you when the quake happened?
So I was sleeping when the quake hit. I've slept through small earthquakes before, but boy, not this one. The whole house was shaking. You know it's bad when you actually kind of lose your balance as you're trying to walk in a straight line. I ran from my door and I almost stumbled and fell over as it was the whole house was shaking. I'm on the 11th floor though, so maybe I felt it a little more than some other people in Taipei.
Oh, I'm right there with you. I'm also on the 11th floor. About running to your door, we're going to cover that, some of the do's and do nots when earthquakes actually happen. I remember I was hanging out with my boys just early morning. They just had their breakfast.
You have two sons. You don't mean like hanging out with the homies.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. That's right. And being Taiwanese, we've always thought that, I'm going to get used to these things. But really, when a big one happens, you submit to the freakish power of Mother Nature. And you're like, well, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen.
Yeah, it's definitely a moment where you remember that Earth is in charge, no matter how much you try to take control of your life. So obviously, since we're both in Taipei, this was centered on the east coast of Taiwan, where it was much worse. All of the updates and the damage that you see coming out of Taiwan from this earthquake are mainly from there, near the city of Hualien. So in terms of Taiwan, economy so far, the chip-making giant Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC, and other companies are reporting that the financial impact of this month's earthquake will be minimal. But that's a bit different from the last time Taiwan had a huge earthquake on September 21st, 1999, which is commonly referred to in Chinese as the famous 921 earthquake. That came in at a magnitude of 7.3, just a little bit bigger than this recent one, with its epicenter in Taiwan's central city of Nantou. But that earthquake had a death count of around 2,400, with about 11,000 injured. And the chipmaker TSMC reported considerable losses, leading to chip shortages in multiple countries and billions of USD equivalent in losses. So what's the difference? Well, this time around, Taiwan was much more prepared, which is perhaps the main reason why damage and the loss of human lives were much lower. How has Taiwan managed that? We'll cover that in a bit. But Joey, where were you when the 921 earthquake hit 25 years ago?
I was luckily not in the country. I was in Canada studying, and so were my parents. But it's a scary one. And my dad is in real estate in construction. So he has told me stories about how that completely changed the sort of building and construction landscape of Taiwan. But we'll get to that in a bit. Trevor, before this one, have you ever experienced any major earthquakes?
Yeah. I mean, like, if you ask anyone who's experienced a big earthquake, they almost always know exactly. They have a, you know, visceral, visual and audio memory of everything that was happening that moment. One of my earliest memories, I think, I was about 5 years old. In 1994, there was a Northridge earthquake in Southern California around Los Angeles. That earthquake was only about a 6.7, but I remember waking up in the middle of night. I was like 4 or 5, stumbling in my parents' room, seeing things fall off the shelves. It's really scary because, like we said, you know, you can't do anything about it. You really just have to like hold on to something and try not to fall over.
Yeah, but you were in a house, right?
I was in a house at that time, yeah, on the second floor.
Oh, that's much better than compared to like high rises here in Taiwan.
Yeah.
So we can learn a lot in the aftermath of an earthquake, or really any natural disaster for that matter. So after that 921 quake, we started reevaluating our building codes, which were forever changed since. And that played a critical role in limiting the damage to homes for this particular earthquake that just happened. The number of buildings in Taiwan featuring seismic dampening elements, which is used to limit floor vibration during earthquakes, has drastically increased. And Taiwan's iconic Taipei 101 Tower, for example, one of the world's tallest building, contains a large dampening ball designed to prevent the building from swaying during earthquakes.
Did you know the Taipei 101 even has a mascot for the damper ball? It's called the Damper Baby. Yeah,
really?
It's a big selling point of the 101.
So the Taiwanese government also identify areas that are at greater risk of earthquake damage due to their proximity to active fault lines, and they would demand that new buildings in those areas to meet even higher seismic safety regulations. And prior to 921 earthquake in 1999, we didn't really have a special search and rescue team. Now there are specialist teams that use technology, including thermal imaging, life detectors with seismic sensors, life support, and large-scale destructive equipment to, you know, dig people out of the rubbles. And of course, the rescue personnel are much better trained these days. Now, even the private sector, disaster relief funds, donation mechanisms, and volunteers have gotten much better at emergency response efforts. We'll cover that in just a little bit more in details. Lastly, the government also improved their ability to understand the warning signs of earthquakes. They developed and implemented earthquake early warning systems. It's a series of sensors and about 200 monitoring stations across the island, and they allow authorities to generate shake maps. And these maps are critical in helping rescue teams to focus their efforts on the hardest hit areas. The precise measurements generated are also used to quickly determine an earthquake's epicenter, allowing the EEW system to trigger a mobile phone alert for people in high risk areas. So just seconds after the earthquake was detected on Wednesday morning, Taiwan's Central Weather Administration issued a warning to people in affected counties, giving them precious seconds to find cover. However, did you ever get a warning, Trevor?
I did not get a warning for this one. There has been one time where I got a warning once. This was a couple years ago, and I got the warning about 10 seconds before the actual earthquake hit. So I know that, you know, it can work really well, but right now I think they must still be figuring out the issues with it.
Yeah, and the government has announced that it will reassess the alert algorithms after complaints that some people in less affected counties, such as you and I here in Taipei, we didn't receive the alert when we probably should have. I know I definitely didn't get one, and I was left wondering why. So after this earthquake in April of 2024, people started discussing what exactly should we do to protect ourselves. So Trevor, got a few questions for you. Do you know what's the first thing you should do when there is an earthquake?
Okay, so I was raised, again, in California, we have a lot of earthquakes. So we have a lot of like earthquake education and classes. And I was told to stand in a doorway because if something falls down from either side of the, like, it's less likely to fall down. I haven't really, you know what? It's been like, I'm 34 now and I've never really questioned that knowledge or looked it up. So I guess I'm about to find out.
Same with me. I've been told certain things, but then a lot of the information that we were taught were like decades old. So it's time to update some of these information. The first thing you should always do when there's an earthquake is to stay down and find cover instead of running around to what you think might be an ideal location. The second question is, Trevor, where do you think you should hide? And obviously, you think you should hide under a doorway or close to a doorway.
Well, if there's a table available, I'm assuming you should get under the table, right?
You should definitely get under a table.
Yeah.
I was told doorways, and also I was told that you're supposed to open doors in case they get bent out of shape and it blocks your escape route. I was also told that you should find pillars because pillars will likely support the building better. And in the case of a collapse, there's probably just a small space for you to duck under. And I was also taught that if you can find a large piece of metal furniture like your refrigerator, which stands next to a pillar, that's the safest place. Turns out you're not supposed to run to any of those locations. Just find a place to duck and cover. A table is the ideal location because if it's a magnitude 7 and above, it's really hard to run. In the midst of trying to get to the right location, you could really hurt yourself.
Yeah, I thought you were going to tell me to get in the refrigerator, which is definitely not. It's not Indiana Jones 4.
No, it's not. Lastly, Trevor, you're supposed to prepare an emergency bag or emergency bag of goodies for earthquake or any natural disasters. Do you want to name some of the items that you think should go into this bag?
Gosh, probably a first aid kit, a flashlight, and some snacks. No, I can't think of anything else.
Yeah. All the above that you mentioned, ropes apparently help if you're in a tall building, radio, and some water in addition to some snacks. But of course, food's usually perishable. You can get canned food, but you know, you probably want to replace those every once in a while. One thing that a lot of the Japanese households is basically a must-have are whistles, because when you're buried under rubbles, having a whistle really helps, especially when you're running out of energy and you don't really have the energy to yell for help.
Yes, exactly. And also, some people think that there's sort of a binary, like either the earthquake kills you instantly or you survive and you get out fine. But there are places, like we mentioned, where you can get stranded in the mountains, maybe between two rockfalls or a blocked off road, and you might be out there for, you know, days. So you should keep some stuff in your car too, just to be safe.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so not just the people who learned how to respond better and the government to have better systems in place, but even the charities around Taiwan are much more efficient. Almost immediately after the quake, humanitarian organizations work with the government to set up tents, shelters, provide food, medical care, transportation, and even distributed cash to help out those who are most affected. And not the least of which is an organization called Ciji Charity Foundation. That's Taiwan's biggest international humanitarian NGO. And here's a piece from Taiwan Plus.
Just for this one day only, here at this primary school in Hualien, volunteers from Ciji, Taiwan's largest Buddhist foundation, are giving out cash and other donations to people affected by the earthquake, giving out more than $350,000 in aid. Founded in Hualien by a Buddhist nun in the 1960s, Ciji has a long history of disaster response, and it now has 10 million volunteers working in over 60 countries.
These people, they are hurt, they're sad, and they're afraid. What can we provide for them? More than just food, more than just money. I think we need to give them comfort. We need to give them a sense of support.
So yeah, the Ciji Charity Foundation here in Taiwan, that's spelled T-Z-U-C-H-I. It might not look how it sounds, just because we're on a podcast. But the person we just heard in that soundbite is Joe Huang, and he's been a volunteer for the Ciji Charity Foundation for more than 20 years and a member of the April 3rd Hualien Earthquake Disaster Response Coordination Team. We asked Joe, how was Ciji there so fast?
I think it was 2018, I believe. There was a previous earthquake that happened in Hualien. From there, we realized that our process needs to improve. So starting from then, we began to have a lot more what's called the PPP, or the public-private partnership. Before, we already were very close with the local and the central federal government. But now we actively pursue partnership. We all remember 1999 when the infamous 921 earthquake happened. our Taiwanese government also making strides to improve many of the disaster response. And so there was a natural match where we are now having a lot more partnership with the government, including staff training, including volunteer training, including volunteer awareness, including all these several issues related to emergency response. So this time, on the morning of April 3rd, and right away we set up an outdoor emergency response center here at our headquarters, global headquarters here at the Jingzi Hall, which is sort of like a community center in Hualien City. And right away we were connecting to the disaster response team here in Hualien, including the firefighters team, including the local police and the local government. So in order to set up this very quick response, a lot of it actually comes from the government. And our mobility comes from our volunteers. It's really a cooperation between the volunteers, the foundation, and also the network, the partnership that we have built with the city and also with the government.
Yeah, so like Joe mentioned, there are a lot of different kinds of rescue efforts. There are medical services. Those come first. Obviously, you want to survive first. But then after that, Tsuji Foundation does things like bringing blankets to people and giving relief care. And the Tsuji Foundation also helps with setting up shelters and schools sometimes. So right after this earthquake struck at 7:58 a.m., same morning, they were there.
It also helps that Tsuji's home base is actually in Hualien, but certainly they got there real fast. And Joe was telling me that immediately during and after the earthquake, people started making calls, even just volunteers who were on their way to work. They sort of knew exactly what role they have to play in the relief efforts. A lot of the equipment that were quite available, all it took was just to get them to the right places. And that's quite impressive.
So let's hear from Joe again on his experiences working with Tsuji Foundation and exactly what it does and where.
I joined Tsuji about 25 years ago. I also had various opportunities to be able to attend and also participate in various international disasters. Some of them are earthquake related. For example, 2015, the Nepal earthquake, as well as early 1990s, when there were many earthquakes happening in Central and South America, especially El Salvador. I was there too. And also 2001 Haiti earthquake. And I was also able to participate in some of the typhoon disaster relief in the Philippines, also in Taiwan. And depending on different type of damages, the help will be various. However, we always focus on something that is most urgent. For example, food, shelter, water. And these are the things that are the very basic needs after all the disaster have passed through. We would have to find local vendors that were able to sell these things, or a major portion of the relief will come from Taiwan or the nearby countries where we might have warehouses and storehouses that we could supply them. Many times, the disaster happened at a place where we don't have such strong volunteer network. Then we would require local or nearby countries where there are volunteers to head in. So I would say the official number here is 66 countries. We have our offices in the 66 different regions and countries, more than 50, we have very strong volunteer networks.
Yeah, the Tsuji Foundation has also done things like donated thousands of masks and COVID tests during the pandemic. They are fast and they know who to work with. After last year's earthquake in Turkey and Syria, the Tsuji Foundation sent a search and rescue team there to participate in some rescue efforts. And after this month's earthquake in Taiwan, a Turkish search and rescue team flew back over to Taiwan to help here. So that's nice.
Yeah, actually, that tends to happen a lot here with Taiwan, is that we really, when you do these things, when you make these efforts, it's sort of almost like a citizen's diplomatic approach.
As a small island, we can't mobilize the same amount of help as other countries can, but we are doing what we can.
Yeah. So Joe said that Tsuji has regional offices in 66 different countries or regions, and more than 50 of them are in close relationship with Tsuji Foundation, and they have a lot of volunteers who can lend helping hands during disasters or during humanitarian relief efforts. So I'm curious as to, you know, why are so many people drawn by the efforts of Tsuji and drawn by the call of Tsuji? So I asked Joe, why is Tsuji Charity Foundation so successful here in Taiwan and around the world?
Let me start by saying that I think compassion and altruism, it's just waiting to be inspired. And also the particular historical background And at the time of development in Taiwan, it all played an important role in shaping the people of this land to understand that, yes, we have received help before. Yes, we have gone through very difficult time. And yes, we have understood the values of being frugal, work hard, and be diligent. These are all very good qualities of the people of this land. And that's why it resonated really well, allow us to pull all these compassion and goodness together from all over the world to channel that love to those people that need them. In Taiwan or in other Asian countries where age population is growing more and more, many of them are just sitting at home, waiting for the next thing to happen, waiting for lunch, waiting for dinner, waiting for kids to come home, waiting for grandkids to come home. But here we empower them so that they are now able to step out of their home and make changes to this world because they believe. So I think empowerment is one thing. Inspiring of their nature goodness is another. But when you put the two together, inspire their goodness and make them believe that they can make a change. And I think this is what we're seeing all over the world.
So Trevor, you know those moments when you're, say, in a bus and you see an old lady, I don't know why it's an old lady, but you see an old lady coming onto the bus and carrying bags of very heavy stuff in her hands, and you feel like you should probably get up and help out. Those moments, they could pass really quickly. Like you could walk away really quickly and wondering if you should have done something for the next few minutes and forget about it. Well, I think what Joe is trying to say is that Cixi Foundation is trying to inspire those moments to turn into moments of compassion and altruism to actually do something about it. Cixi has a very intricate network of volunteers to help out every weekend to do anything from environmental work to humanitarian efforts. And I think they're just trying to inspire people to not only know that you can do something, but also just kind of develop a habit of helping out people. And I think that really helps in those moments where altruism could really shine. We should probably note that Cixi is a Buddhist foundation, right? However, Taiwan is long known to be a country that has a lot of freedom to practice religious beliefs. So be it, you know, Taoism, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, you know, we have like a lot of praying rooms in a lot of the central transportation hubs here in Taiwan. So like it's a land that respects all the religions and practices. And I think that also helps because really at the core of a lot of religions is to help each other out and communities. Right. And I think that also plays to the advantage of Taiwan.
Yeah, that's really well said, especially the part about those moments passing really quickly. Cixi Foundation having this sort of system in place to be able to be in the right place at the right time and help is exactly what mobilizing is all about. So it's been a rough couple weeks, especially for some people on Taiwan's East Coast. But what we've learned today, besides the facts about the earthquake that struck on April 3rd, is how to prepare yourself in the event of an earthquake. And we've also learned what governments can do to mobilize alert systems and put in place infrastructure, build buildings better, and be more prepared for earthquakes in the future. And in the past 25 years between these two earthquakes, a lot has been put in place that has helped Taiwan survive this one better.
That's right. And we also mentioned the charity foundations, the humanitarian NGOs here in Taiwan helping out during earthquake reliefs. We spoke with someone from Cixi today, but really there are so many organizations that are doing their parts quite efficiently as well during the events of natural disasters. So we're quite fortunate to be surrounded by people who mobilize into actions and help out those who are most in need.
And those moments of helping opportunity can pass by quickly. So the next time you see someone in need, make sure they feel lucky to have you around. So that wraps up today's episode. Thank you for joining us, and I hope we got Pacific enough for you. I am Trevor Tortomasi, and you can find me on all social media platforms at Trebotsky.
And I am Joey Chow. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Joey Taipei.
And if you like podcasts, check out Taiwan Plus's tech podcast, Innovative Minds, co-hosted by Taiwan's own Minister of Digital Affairs, Audrey Tang, as well as our short series, The Ripple Effect Podcast. We've also got more interviews and deep dives into recent news stories in our shows Zoom In, Zoom Out, and Connected with Divya Kopalan. And if you want even more news and views from Taiwan and around the world, check out the huge catalog of news and entertainment on our website, taiwanplus.com, as well as on YouTube, Instagram, or Twitter. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again on Getting Pacific.